Blog Talk Radio.
Well, God bless you and welcome to another episode of Can We Be Real? This is Reverend Carl White, and I'm happy to be here this evening once again on our Thursday evening on our Blog Talk Radio. And if you would like to join into our conversation, maybe you have a question, or you would like to come into our commentary, and you have a comment that you would like to add to our discussion, it would be most wonderful to have you to join us. You can call 347-855-8793. Once again, that number is 347-855-8793. And tonight we're going to be talking about something that's very near and dear to my heart. We're talking about our youth. And the topic this evening is education versus incarceration. In the United States, the youth of color, especially those of color who are usually darker than sky blue, black and Latino mainly, they're caught in the crossfire of the war on drugs, and they're subject to persecution and incarceration. They're often denied access to educational opportunities, or at least poor educational opportunities that usually result in discipline as opposed to transferring knowledge. The irony is that the war on drugs is often defended as necessary policy to protect even the nation's young people. But the reality is that protecting the youth and the drug war has resulted in institutionalized persecution of black, Latino, and Native American young people. And while more and more young men and women of color are being ushered into the criminal justice system under the guise of fighting drugs or resources for education are diminishing, we've got more young folk in prison and also than we do in some colleges. And that statistic is it goes hand in hand. Sometimes they say it's, you know, at the same parity or less. But the truth of the matter is that America incarcerates more of its citizens than any nation in the world, including communist China, Russia, and Saudi Arabia. Right now, we have almost 2.4 million individuals behind bars, and over 7 million either on the direction or on probation and parole under the auspices of the criminal justice system. The problem is that with the higher amount of incarceration, there are lower and lower levels of education. And tonight we've got some resident scholars who've joined in with us. One of our local attorneys, I believe she is on the line with us, Attorney Robin Shipp. Are you with us?
Good evening. How are you, Reverend Carl?
I'm doing well. God bless you in a real way. I thank you for taking time from your busy schedule, and I know you consider it a ministry to actually work and to help a lot of the young folks who have been adjudicated by the system and teaching them ways and means to actually do better. And with all of these high levels of youth being incarcerated and getting in criminal activity, what do you say that it would turn it around?
You know, it's an interesting question. I think it is. It's a system that has broken down, but it's not merely our state system or, you know, our government. It is also a breakdown in our belief and commitment to family. What's astonishing to me, I learned not too long ago that we had, and I'm speaking specifically of the African American community, we had more intact families immediately after slavery than we have today.
Wow, that's very horrifying to think that, but it's true.
Right, And we have got to get back to the notion in the African-American community in particular that a family, a mother and a father raising their children is something that we value again. I think proportionally it has a direct impact on crime that is occurring and some of the other things that occur, such as a devaluation of education and a sense that work is something that we don't want to place a high value on, and obtaining employment commensurate with educational experience. We have moved away from that and are instead, the youth that I see today, driven by a desire for quick, flashy, monetary gain and a willingness to attain this at any rate, any cost.
Now, some of the things, too, that, I mean, you bring up a lot of issues there. One of the things that I really is focused on even this evening is education portion of it. And they have plenty of studies that have proven that the higher the education, the lower the incarceration rate. I'm not saying that everyone is desirous or has the ability to make it through formal college education, but I am saying that everyone has the right to have a college education if they have the capacity to do it. And the reason why I say that, because I've worked with youth in my mentoring program called Transforming Lives, and literally we would work with felons and misdemeanors, those individuals who had to do probation, and we would teach them life skills. We would teach them how to make better decisions, just decision-making process. And most of them, as you said, it reverts back to the family that they can have someone who they can depend on who has some knowledge and wisdom and experience that they can't get from each other. In fostering that type of environment, it gave them an opportunity to open up and be for real. One of the things that really, like you said too, is that the desire for quick money or flashy money, and I don't think that's a bad desire, because that was one of the things that was instilled in me to go to school, get a good education, get a good job. Unfortunately, you know, my dad's generation, man, they could be a plumber, a pipe fitter, electrician, and, you know, buy a house, have a car, and send their kids to school and, you know, live a pretty good life. Most of those jobs have dried up. So what do you see as far as how can we reach the young folks? Or do you know of methods that have allowed for them to be, say, a little more excited about doing the right thing?
You know, I think it all, it focuses back on the educational foundation that they received. And as you're aware, here in the state of Georgia, we decide how many prisons to build today based on how well Johnny or Susie are able to read in the second and the third grade.
Wow.
If you have... Yeah, it's a wow type of statistic. If you have young people who are unable to read in the second or third grade, then that is how the state of Georgia decides the numbers of prisons to build. So if we were to focus the resources on the front end in education, as opposed to on the back end in building prisons,
right,
and we've given our young people an opportunity to at least attain the foundation that would instill in them a desire to pursue higher education. And, you know, you said that plumbers and electricians are in scarcity, and it's difficult to earn a living. There are actually, have you hired a plumber lately? Plumbers are making pretty good money. And when you have an economic cycle that like the one we're presently in, mm-hmm. where values of homes have been pressed down, making a lot more properties affordable for individuals who would be considered in blue-collar trades.
Mm-hmm.
That is how we would be able to reverse this type of financial downturn that we're in. So actually, I think that skilled labor positions like plumbers, ironically enough, everybody's talking about the miners in Chile.
Right.
They were considered skilled labor force. It's a highly skilled position to do that type of mining. There are a number of
as well.
Yeah, extremely dangerous.
Right.
But there are a number of positions that, and with the state's emphasis on giving young people an opportunity at a technical education, advanced education beyond high school, as well as the opportunity, as we have here in the state of Georgia, for the Hope Scholarship, creates a world for young people who perhaps don't want to go to college, that they're just not seen because they can't see beyond what the latest rapper may have on and their desire to have that same type of thing, the desire for things versus the desire for a future.
Yes, it's amazing, though. But I think sometimes when we look at some of the predictors, when they decide the number of prisons to build and someone is in second or third grade, it automatically assumes that those people pretty much have been written off to the system.
Right, right, exactly. And, you know, according to a study by, I need to make sure that I'm quoting the Sentencing Project, which was is a research and advocacy group for reform, nonprofit group. Since the early 1970s, the prison and jail population in the United States has increased by a total of 500%.
Wow. Wow. We have another caller. I want you to hold on the line if you can, and
sure.
We'll see if we can't bring in the other caller. Caller, you're on the air from 404. Are you there, 663?
Yes, I'm here.
Yes. Did you want to join in on the conversation?
Yes, I did. Brother Carl?
Yes. How you doing there, Brother Kenny?
I'm doing good.
What? Thank you for calling in this evening. We appreciate you taking time from your busy schedule because I know that prison ministry is near and dear to your heart. In fact, we were in the Atlanta Union Mission just most recently, and we were looking at possibly doing some prison ministry together. So with your experience as far as working with the homeless population and working with that population, what are some of the things that you say can be done to actually turn that around?
I believe it'll be education. Education, because if you start with the kids while they are young, to get them that education, to get them that knowledge, then you could point them to the right direction. Now, like you have most of the people that's in prison now, depends on their educational level. Because, you know, what would you have to look for if you think this would get you money? Does crime pay? No, it don't pay. So you have people just out there just want to live their lives fast with fast money, but then when they get caught, you do the crime, you do the time. So I think it's education.
Yeah, education is I think is one portion of it, but we really must be able to have some livable wages and jobs, security for individuals as well. One of the things that it's amazing to we have educated people. I know people with PhDs who work at Walmart.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mhm. And I believe that because the jobs are scarce now, being the economy the way it is.
Mm-hmm.
So in the midst of a downturn and so forth like that, how do we help someone who basically has their back against the wall? And that's open to either you, because Robin, you're still on the line too, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is. It's difficult now at these days of time. Like you say, you're trying to help somebody. But you can really start with the education. You know, our eyes are basically blind when it comes to awareness and how this society is. Because the caller earlier, when she mentioned slavery, if you got a group that was held back for so long,
mm-hmm.
but then when you open the doors for them, then we tend to walk in the door kind of slow because we wasn't, you know, ready for this. Like, hey, now we got freedom to do whatever. But then you look at the way society bends the rules, and you could say a little bit would be prejudice, you know, but that shouldn't stop an individual. But only thing that stops it is the mentality of that person. And I say that because, Brother Carl, you recall when Moses freed the slaves. They were slaves. But when Moses freed the Israelites, it took them 40 years before they can actually enter into that promised land.
Most of them didn't. Two out of the original group that actually entered in,
mm-hmm.
Joshua and Caleb.
That's right.
All the parents, they passed away in the wilderness, but that's a whole other story. But go ahead.
But my point is they didn't make it because of their mentality was slavery. You know, Moses was a diplomat. He couldn't go in and say, hey, we're going to fight these people before we get in there. Those people had to die off, and then a new generation had to be raised up. And Joshua raised up warriors. So that's what I'm saying about our generation now. Our generation now, we have to raise up scholars, scientists, astronauts. So we're not raising up that new breed. We're raising up people that still want to stick to crime. And then
Maybe Robin can answer this one better. Why is there such a propensity in poor neighborhoods to crime?
There was a time when we as a community all lived together.
Yes.
Doctor, lawyer, Indian chief, our mortician, the pharmacist, the garbage man,
right.
The street sweeper, exactly, the domestic. We all lived together, and we had an opportunity to be exposed to what upward mobility looked like.
Mm-hmm.
After desegregation, which my mother, who, as you know, Reverend Carl, has a great deal of wisdom,
mm-hmm.
in having lived and experienced the transition from a segregated society to a desegregated society, often says that one of the worst things that happened to African Americans was desegregation, and that it was actually not the intent for us to have a desegregated world, in her belief. It was rather the intent for us to have equal, the same textbooks, the same classroom environment,
mm-hmm.
not necessarily a desegregated world. Now, I don't
mm-hmm.
necessarily agree with her because I believe that desegregation had to occur because that's how we began to socialize and assimilate and have accomplished some wonderful things in the African-American community as a result of desegregation. But I think that she has a very valid point when it comes to our living environment because we are still very much to a certain extent, desegregated. We're segregated. We're segregated on Sunday, and we're segregated in our neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm.
And
it is, I agree.
Yes, and so when you have concentrations of poor people living in the same neighborhood, and you no longer have the doctors and the lawyers living in the same community, those who are social or economically, quote unquote, poor,
mm-hmm.
don't see in their own community the possibilities of upward mobility. They don't see what they can accomplish if they focus on attaining a good education because the doctor no longer lives in their community. So then that begs the question. I was just going to say, is there a responsibility for those who have kept their feet to the fire and attained attained degrees and advanced degrees to live in a community that they grew up in, so to speak? I think to a certain extent there is that responsibility.
Now, a friend of mine, he actually, he had been in a bad situation, and I think he did some pushing paper, illegal forgery stuff. And he was saying to me, and this was back many years ago, he said black folk in the streets selling drugs, as opposed to peoples of other communities that sell drugs, they sell them behind closed doors. So they sell them to anybody, so then in turn they end up getting busted more, they end up selling to undercover agents, and that oftentimes law enforcement would tend to target those who are outside selling it, bringing up the disparities in sentencing guidelines between powder cocaine and crack cocaine, those type of things, heavier sentences, heavier fines to pay, and it makes it really very difficult to get out of the system once you're in it.
Right.
The drugs in the prison sentencing, and then once you get in the prison, there's racial separation there too, like the Aryans, the Latinos, Mexicans, and the blacks. You can't, you know, intermingle upon. So like they keep it separated, or they tend to feed the same fire. One of the things is that the and then in society there was a study he had mentioned where they had created mock prison records for white men and black men with no prison record, and they both applied for the same job and found out
mm-hmm.
that white men were more employable.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, that is the reality of so many situations that we live in. How do we get around racial discrimination and overt racism or institutionalized racism?
Boy, that's a big one. It's almost this self-perpetuating notion of, you know, failure.
Mm-hmm.
Because you make a choice to go out and sell drugs.
Yes.
And you do that because you have a desire to attain things. You have a desire to acquire money. Perhaps you have a desire to live in a better house, or, you know, you have a desire to provide food for your family or siblings where, you know, parents are unable or
mm-hmm.
are unwilling to provide adequately for their children.
Mm-hmm.
Knowing that you are doing something that is illegal,
Right.
And so then when you are caught and sentenced as your form of punishment, either to prison time or to a period on probation, then you are trying to, quote unquote, go straight, but you're unable to accomplish that because you have this record. So it's this self-perpetuating failure. And it's sort of, it's like the chicken or the egg. But I think what a lot of young men have done is going into business for themselves. And it takes a very little.
Legitimate businesses,
exactly. Yes.
Because
I'm sorry,
selling drugs is a business as well.
Yeah, yeah, let's be clear, legitimate.
Yeah, it's definitely, and it's not an easy business either, because that your customers could bust you, the you sell into the police and your buddies and everybody. And so, in fact, in street language, they call the place where they sell the drugs from the trap. And the young folks call it grinding, or you've been trapping. So you imagine that you're working at a place called the trap, and you're grinding, and you know it's illegal, so you can't ever really rest. But go ahead with your point.
Yeah, but do you see the intelligence that has to exist in order to, you know, it's dumb in the sense that you're doing something illegal, but when you remove, let's separate ourselves from the illegality of it, the notion of it being a business, which I agree with you, it is a business. Selling illegal substances is done as a business, and then there's strata to it where there's a hierarchy. There's the person who actually deals with whomever the supplier is, and they distribute it to individuals who actually do the sales.
Right.
So it is
street-level dealers.
Street-level dealers, exactly.
Right.
But it is a business. So if our young people can use the brain that they have to establish that business, which is extremely high-pressured because you're constantly looking at the possibility of being incarcerated or killed for that space.
Yes.
So that, because if it's a profitable space, somebody is looking at you being profitable in that space and wants to take that territory from you. So you're looking at injury or death. If you can take that energy and channel it into a legitimate business, because the brain hasn't changed, it's still the intelligence to run a business. It's just now a legitimate business, and you've eliminated the stress of the possibility of incarceration. You've eliminated the stress of the possibility of injury or serious injury or death, and instead you're doing something that enables you to be out in the light of day with your head held high.
Now, do you find many actually want to get involved in a situation like that where they want to turn their life around?
I think everybody wants to turn their life around when they're arrested.
Yes.
You know, it's sort of like, you know, the person who gets a bad diagnosis from the doctor and they all of a sudden learn how to pray.
Right.
Oh, God, please, if you'll just get me out of this, I'll take better care of my health. And I'm certain that many of my clients say the same thing. Oh, God, please, if you would just get me out of this, I will go straight. Now, by no means do I mean to imply that all of my clients are guilty, because not all of them are guilty. But those are different conversations.
Sure.
Those who are guilty, and I'm thinking of one in particular. He has sworn to me up, down, sideways, and cockeyed that he is going to go straight because he just can't handle the stress of doing this anymore. Will he do it? I don't know. I don't know if it's so ingrained in him that you know, he will be able to get out of that life. I just don't know.
Let's take another caller and see if they can't come in and chime in on it. You're listening to Can We Be Real, and we're talking about youth education versus incarceration. You're on the line, caller. You look like you're calling from a block number. Are you there?
Hello, can you hear me?
Oh, Reverend Joseph, how you doing,
hey,
sir?
Hey, how you doing?
You got
Mr.
the secret.
Carl?
Yes, yes, you got the secret number calling.
No, it's no secret number. Just came up that way. But I've been on since Attorney Robin was on, and I think that was Brother Kenny, and I've enjoyed the input, the conversation, the dialogue between all of you all. And I think what is important is the fact that education is a key, not only for the children, but we have to ask about the education of their parents. And it is stated in documentation that if the parents are educated, then they will have the wherewithal to know that education is a pivotal point for their children. But flip side of it is if the parents are not, and if they're barely making it, and as Robin has stated, that we used to be more communal. We used to have that. I remember it growing up, you know, in the community where you would have the police and you would have the teachers and you would have visible role models, but then all of a sudden they left the community.
Yes.
And so you've had the young folks, who were they going to look up to? Those who did not have the best education. And with regards to our educational system in the disadvantaged areas, you did not have the best teachers. You did not have resources available. And so now I think it was in Chicago. I know Chicago was one of the districts that had the lottery system, where now you get a number, and now you can go to the better school, and you may have an opportunity to do better with regards to your education, and you just might have a chance. But it is in education, and it has to start earlier on. Because once the kids, I do believe, once they are incarcerated, once they have been adjudicated by the system, I'd like for Robin to maybe comment, if she's still online, about the recidivism rate, because that's something else. You know, you get out, it's your hope not to do crime again, but then when there are no opportunities, you know, no jobs, you know, nobody is really beating the door down to hire a felon.
Are you there, Sammy DeRon?
Yes, I am.
All right. That's my hero on the phone, y'all. That's my hero, Sammy DeRon. He can speak exactly to recidivism and coming in and out of prison. I didn't ask you for permission to tell your business, but I know you're willing to share, because we're working on doing a documentary. You want to tell your story, Sammy DeRon?
Yeah, I ain't got that long, Carl. I'm at work, man, but I have.
Okay, well, go ahead. Just give us a little bit, and I'll finish up after you get off the line.
Okay, I didn't even really hear what you said. What did you say now?
With regard to your story as far as where you are now and how you got there.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so, I started out, I guess, like a lot of folks out the neighborhood started out, you know. I did what everybody else was doing because I didn't feel like it was any other way. That's the way that I seen, so that's what I did. You know, it wasn't
doing crime, doing drugs, doing all of that.
It was against the law. It was doing drugs. It was whatever they was doing, that's what I was doing. You know,
okay.
I did that for quite some time. You know,
30
until
years.
We got, 30 plus years.
30
you
plus
know,
years.
So,
and right now you're not in prison. Am I right about it?
No, I'm not. Right now I'm at work.
He's at work. And now tell us about your work, what you do.
Well, I'm a peer specialist, so I'm – I guess what I do is, you know, I've been there, I've done that. You know, I worked my way out of depression, out of a criminal lifestyle, and I'm trying to be a shining example for those that are still, you know, on the bad road.
Yes, And so you work with felons, you work with people who are coming out of the system, and in fact, you've been employed and out of the prison system for over a year now. Am I right about it?
Well, close to 2.5 years.
Close to 2.5 years now. And, you right now, you talking about somebody who was incarcerated in and out ever since you was, what, 14 years old?
Yeah, I believe 14 or 15.
14 or 15 years
seen,
old, my little brother. Huh? Go ahead.
Yeah, I hadn't seen a year on the streets since I was, the last year I seen on the streets, I was 50. I was 14 years old, and I just actually received my whole full year on the streets since then. In 2008. So from being 14 to 2008, I never did a complete year on the streets.
And how old are you now?
I am 49 now.
You're 49 years old. What is 633-0134?
633-1134. That's that number they gave me. in the Department of Correction.
That's Department of Correction. And you don't have to carry that number, do you?
No, I don't got to carry it no more. I told them, I just, one that last time, I told them they can keep that.
They can keep that number. And so now you have a Social Security number, right?
Yes, I do.
Amen. Well, I applaud you. We still going to do the documentary on your life because this is just the tip of the iceberg. And I tell y'all, this is my hero, Sammy Deron Wells. He is a hero. This Negro is my little brother. He's the best in the world. And if anybody needs any inspiration to get up out of this situation, send me an email. Go to my website, helpsomebody.net. And you can turn your life around. You don't have to be a criminal. You don't have to be stuck on drugs. You don't have to stay in that situation and be locked up and locked down. You can come out and be free. Amen, Sammy Deron?
Yeah, if I can do it, anybody can do it.
There you go.
God bless you.
All right. I'll let you get back to work. Thank you for participating.
All right, thank you. Y'all have a good one.
All right.
Be blessed.
That's my little brother, y'all. So go ahead, Robin. With regard to recidivism, like, you're just talking to my little brother, Sammy Deron, who just stayed. He's 49 years old. He was involved in the criminal justice system. Like he said, if they were doing it, he'd done it for 30-plus years. And now he's a peer specialist. He's a counselor. Is that a hero story? And I mind you to say, he's not in the state of Texas or Georgia.
Well,
wow.
Yeah, that's a remarkable testimony. Remarkable. I unfortunately don't have at my fingertips the exact data as it pertains to recidivists.
Mm-hmm.
I understand that individuals who have been previously incarcerated are 2 times more likely to reoffend. But the actual data as released by either the Department of Justice or some other tracking institution, I don't have that at my fingertips, unfortunately.
Yes. Well, one of the things, they say it's about 65% to 70% right now. Another number in DeKalb County Jail, 85% to 95% of the inmates do not have a high school education or a GED. Most can't even balance a checkbook. One of my buddies, he told me that if you want to know where the quality criminals are, usually the guys that run the big operations with the education, they're in the Fed system because they're the ones that get caught for racketeering and embezzlement and yada, yada, yada. The local system is almost a revolving door in a sense. And oftentimes people get involved in the system and they can't get out because they don't have opportunities to get out. I knew one young man who his child support back payments was $90,000. He did not have a job. He was in and out of jail on a regular basis. And I was coming home one day about 8 in the morning, and I see him, and his eyes was red as a stop sign. And he's walking down the street, and I was a younger man at that time, and he called me Mr. White. He always called me Mr. White, Mr. White, Mr. White. And I said, man, what you doing out here? He said, man, I'm coming in. I said, so what you going to do? He said, man, I'm going to get high. I said, you going to get high? He said, yeah. I got $90,000 in child support. I got four kids I'm supposed to pay. I can't get along with nobody. I ain't going back to jail, but I can get high. And that's the sense of hopelessness that is out there. People don't have access to ways and means and resources, so they do what they do. I have another hypothesis. They often wonder why poor people continue to have children. It doesn't cost money to have children. Not initially. And it's something they can do without paying. So the thing is that oftentimes the low-hanging fruit becomes the bare minimum for many of criminal mentality, because you say, if you don't have anything to live for, if you don't have any hope, if you don't have anything to stop you from I would minister in prison to guys who are doing life. Guys who are doing 20-20, and I tell you, if you really want to get to know your God, go to prison and get locked in a room with people who are doing life, and because they'll know if you're shucking and jiving and carrying on right then and there, and you need to really be able to connect in a way that's truthful and meaningful, and you really need to, as Grandma say, know God for yourself. And the thing is that When people have nothing to lose, they have nothing to live for. But even those guys in prison that I told them things like, if no matter how much they lock up your body, they can never lock up your mind unless you give it to them. And the problem is that when you can't say no, if somebody offers you a meaningless job that pays minimum wage and you can't say no, then you have no options and you have no choice. And often the young folks, they're looking at older folks and they're saying, well, what did your education do for you? If it was so good, how come you aren't, you know, driving a Bentley and flying in a Gulfwing jet and living in a palace on the French Riviera? And those things, because that's what's popular in our society. And so many of them, they want a ways and a means to move ahead. And I know I'm going on and taking over the conversation a little bit, but I just want to make these points. In the year 2009, we had 25 hedge managers who earned, top hedge fund managers, they got an average in 2009 of $1 billion each. Not million, that's billion with a B. So these 25 individuals made $1 billion. So if you figure out how much $1 billion is to make that in 1 year, that's $83 million a month, or $21 million a week, or $4 million a day, or $500,000 an hour. What does one person do to earn $500,000 an hour? That's a very sobering question.
It is. It is indeed.
And you know their tax rate? 17%. Right. You're listening to Can You Be Real? I think we've got another caller on the line, and you're listening to Reverend Carl on Can You Be Real? Maybe you want to join our conversation. We're here every Thursday, and the call-in number is 347-855-8793. Caller, Reverend Kenny, are you still there?
I'm still here.
Did you want to get back in on our conversation, or did you get stuck on that $1 billion a year?
I got stuck on that $1 billion a year because, you know something? The stock market is a form of legalized gambling.
Yes.
Because you take a gamble just to get in it.
Yes.
But it's legal. Now, for the hedge fund guys, now,
mm-hmm.
I would call that greed.
Yes. $500,000 an hour?
That is greed. And how much are they pouring back into the system? Pouring back into
Well, they got taxed at 17%, so that was, what, out of a billion, that'd be $170 million.
Sound like a
Nothing.
Go buy me another island with that type of money.
Right.
Versus.
Well, I want to kind of move the conversation ahead because we're coming down to the end of the hour. We're getting there. A wonderful education model, and I have the books up on the website. If you're looking at it on the web, it is the book is by Paul Tough, T-O-U-G-H, and it's called Whatever It Takes. It features the educational model of Jeffrey Canada. He has the Harlem Children's Zone and has been running it for a number of years. The beauty of the Harlem Children's Zone is that it takes a holistic system of education that models to break the cycle of generational poverty, because the $1 billion people are making it, and see, they're telling us what we need. We need a whole bunch of money. We need to change the lives of poor people, especially children, in big numbers, not just one-on-one mentoring and not just small stuff. The annual budget for the Harlem Children's Zone right now, well, in 2009, was at $4 million a year, and he raises all of those funds. The average that they spend on per student is $3,500. They actually educate the whole area of the children. The educational model is it's a $40 million annual budget. So they spend $3,500 per child. And they do use a lottery system because they have more children than they actually can take into the school. The model is being adopted by the Obama administration and being replicated all across the nation as far as a model that is looking at combating the poverty, guns, drugs, and crime. They have a full network of services that includes the system of education, social services, and community building. They have impacted 100 square blocks around the area. They focus on taking their students from elementary all the way, in fact, before elementary, they take them all the way to complete college into the job market. They have programs that, here's their programs. They have baby college. They have an all-day pre-K. They have extended day charter schools. They have health clinics. They have community centers for children and adults after school, including weekends and summers. They have a youth prevention facet to it, a youth violence prevention facet, and social services as necessary. What would it take to turn around the systemic and institutionalized violence that we see in an outdated system is that, as we've all stated tonight, is a system of education. The other book that I'm featuring tonight is Angela Davis. Some of y'all might remember Professor Angela Davis from back in the day from the Black Panther movement. I was so blessed to meet her and took a picture with her. God bless her. She spoke at the Ebenezer Baptist Church with Reverend Raphael Warnock about a year or two ago. She has her book out, and the title of the book is Are Prisons Obsolete? Are prisons obsolete? It's a very well-documented book that actually goes into the how the prison system was formulated. And here's a quote that she uses from Charles Dickens, who's the writer. And he speaks about prisons. Now, this was written in 1842 by Charles Dickens. You know Dickens, the one that has the Christmas stuff. He says, with regard to the penitentiary, he says, in its intention, I am well convinced that it is kind, humane, and meant for reformation. But I am persuaded that those who devise this system of prison discipline, those benevolent gentlemen who carry it into execution, do not know that what they are doing. I believe very few men are capable of estimating the immense amount of torture and agony that this dreadful punishment prolonged for years inflicts upon the sufferers. I am only the more convinced that there's a depth of terrible endurance in which none of them but the sufferers themselves can fathom, which no man has a right to inflict upon his fellow creature. I hold this slow and daily tampering with the mysteries of the brain to be immeasurably worse than any torture of the body, because it wounds are not upon the surface, it extorts few cries that human ears can hear. Therefore, I more denounce it as secret punishment, which slumbering humanity is not roused up to stay. He wrote that in 1842, and as we can see, the prison industrial complex, which it is called now, one of the cities in the United States that would be a prime example of the prison industrial complex is that a whole system of economy is built up around prisons. And that city would be Huntsville, Texas. Huntsville, Texas, which is also the home to the executions of the executioner's chamber in Texas. In the city of Huntsville, the number one employer is the headquarters of the Texas Department of Criminal Justice. On average, and I got this from a resident of Waco, Texas, told me that Texas kills an inmate almost every week. Texas by far kills an inmate by every week. Huntsville, Texas, the entire economy is wrapped around prisons. They're the largest employer in Huntsville. Second is the Sam Houston State University. So the prison units that are housed in Huntsville are Bird Unit, Gory Unit, Huntsville Unit, Wynn Unit, and there's one by the name of Holiday Unit. I'm sure it's no holiday to be there. And if any of us who are on the line and you want to get rich, we're down to about 8 minutes on this show, if you want to get rich by any means necessary, build a prison. The prison on average will cost you about $50,000 per cell, and it will be filled before it's finished being built. The problem is that during the 80s, we've had a lot of people who were automatically sentenced on, Robin, you, what's that, mandatory sentencing with, for drug
That's
crimes?
Correct. Mandatory
Yeah, mandatory
minimum.
Sentencing. And some of them got 10 and 20 years. And so it started with the war on drugs. One of the things that is very necessary to know that a drug problem is an addiction. Addiction is a health problem, and we need to start treating them as health problems and looking at the model in other European countries, even like Amsterdam, which is a quite a bit more humane, and needless to say, they don't incarcerate the amount of people that we have. And it's been proven that we cannot build our way out of this prison problem, especially when we have models that allow us to predict the number of failures beginning at second and third grade. That is just horrendous. That is something that all the churches and all the pastors and all the ministers should come together and march against this prison industrial complex that is literally taking, and if you read Marion Wright Elderman's report, just Google Marion Wright Elderman and look at her report on From Cradle to Prison Pipeline. They are literally saying that a child that is born in an underprivileged area and literally has a vocabulary of less than, almost 3 or 4 million words less than another person just for the sake of being born in poverty. And it's wrong. And so the thing is that we cannot justify these injustices and sweep them under the rug because, as Martin Luther King said, justice, injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. One man said that, well, I didn't say anything when they came for the Jews. I didn't say anything when they came for the blacks. I didn't say anything when they came for the women and the children. And now there's coming for me, and there's no one left.
That's right.
Amen. So I think our humanity needs to be paramount in a sense that we take a real sense and look at who am I and what am I doing here? And will it matter that I even lived? Will it be just that he lived, he ate, he slept, he drank, he enjoyed the finest of life, and he's gone? And I got his car and his watch and his house, and oh, my God. But I didn't do anything to make human living better. We're down to 3 minutes. I appreciate all of my guests on the line. God bless you. God keep you. Thank you for sharing your heart and your stories and your time. God bless you, because God knows that you could have been anywhere. You could have been soaking in a hot tub or anything. But I appreciate you coming on the line with us so that we can identify issues that need to be corrected in our lives. And as we live this life, we'll know that we can get better if we stick together. And the family is important. And I think it's just not the nuclear family, but the human family that goes beyond gender, race, politics, economic condition, and even sexual orientation, that we are a human people and we need to break down the walls and the barriers so that we can deal with the real issues and attain a sense of proper self-love. And we must be concerned about every person, because as long as people are enslaved to wrong attitudes toward self, toward others, they cannot help to be express wrong attitude towards themselves and others as well. If the self is not loved, if we're not at home in the self, then how can we ever love our neighbor as ourself? God bless you and God keep you. This is Reverend Carl White, and we're signing off. We're coming to the end of the show, but we'll be back next Thursday. And you can tune in anytime. You can go back to blogtalkradio.com/help somebody. And you can look at our archive of whatever their shows are all there. You can listen to them. And you can call in next week. We'll be back here. The call-in number is 347-855-8793. We thank you very much. And do something for somebody else. Just knowing that if you can move yourself a little bit higher and you can touch the life of someone, and knowing that you're making a difference in that life, then you can come to a point of saying, yes, my life is matters, or my life is worth living, and my life does matter. I'm wishing you the best that God can give you, and knowing that no matter what comes against you, God is always there for you. Did you have anything you want to say, any of our callers? We've got 2 minutes left.
Just God bless you and God keep you. And this is a wonderful ministry, and I'm so excited to have had this opportunity to just be a part of it in a very limited way.
Amen. Well, you're welcome to come back anytime, and we thank you too. And thank you for your work you're doing as well.
Thank you.
Same here, Reverend Carl. It's been a blessing for me to come on and give you some ideas and some pointers and what we could do to help out the homeless, the prison mentality, and the poor.
All right. Well, I appreciate you too, Reverend Kenny, and I look forward to working more with you even as we go forward so that we can do some of these lofty ideas, and maybe we can get some of them billionaires to cut us some checks to really make some real difference in the lives of the homeless.
That's right.
Reverend Joe, you got any closing words? You got 30 seconds.
Hey, I like to say, remember all of you, you have no troubles. All you need is faith in God. Brother Carl, continue to do the work. And know that you're not alone as you, forge ahead. I know that God is with you. And let us be reminded of our youth. And let us also understand that if we can live as we climb, if we can just have the compassion in our hearts to care, sometimes it's just having an ear to hear we can make a difference. I know we can.
Amen, amen. I am just excited about what God is doing. And if we go through life and just look for the best in other people, and the God in us touch the God in them, and we meet heart to heart, as my old friend Brother Blue said, from the middle of the middle of me to the middle of the middle of you. God bless you, and tune in next Thursday at 9 p.m. We'll be right back here. We're going to be talking about cute, sexy, and Christian. How shall we live? God bless you.